Welcome to Talking History. This is Brian Lebeau of Creighton University's Department of History. It may be argued that people learn as much, if not more, about history from the cinema than they do in the classroom. It's certainly the case that history, which has always been standard fare for Hollywood, has received a boost from the film industry. But just what are we learning from historical films? Are we just being given the illusion that we're learning history when in fact we're seeing fiction? That's the subject of our interview today with historian Robert Rosenstone. But first, let's look back at a key event from this week in history. During this week in 1967, President Lyndon B. Johnson nominated and the U.S. Senate confirmed Thurgood Marshall as a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. After being refused admission to the segregated University of Maryland Law School, Marshall attended and graduated with honors from Howard Law School. Marshall began crusading for civil rights, and after serving as chief lawyer for the NAACP, he gained national attention for his fiery yet common-sense prose in struggling for equal rights for all citizens. His big break came in 1954 when he helped represent Brown in the landmark Brown versus Board of Education school desegregation case. Upon his appointment to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in New York, Marshall caught the attention of President Johnson, and in 1967, amidst much national controversy, Johnson named Marshall as the first black justice on the Supreme Court, saying it was the right thing to do, the right time to do it, and that he had chosen the right man and the right place. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, apropos our interview on film and history, we should report that the American Film Institute, as part of its end-of-the-year wrap-up, recently announced its list of the greatest American screen legends, the women and men with the greatest screen presence in American feature-length films since 1950. The top 10 female legends are Katharine Hepburn, Betty Davis, Audrey Hepburn, Ingrid Bergman, and Greta Garbo. The list of top 10 male screen legends includes Humphrey Bogart, Cary Grant, James Stewart, Marlon Brando, and Fred Astaire. You're listening to Talking History. A little over a month ago on Talking History, we looked at the construction and value of historical fiction. That is to say, how historical fiction is created and just how accurate it is historically. Today, Creighton historian Eileen Dugan looks at historical films and asks the same questions of her guest, Robert Rosenstone.
Since the earliest days of cinema, the historical drama has been one of the most popular film genres. There is something about a movie set in the past which attracts us, and we don't seem to care whether it depicts the life of an actual personage like Patton or Braveheart's William Wallace, or places fictional characters against the backdrop of historical events, as in Gone with the Wind and Titanic. But why should we take such cinematic efforts seriously as history, and should we? With us today to explore history on film is Dr. Robert A. Rosenstone, professor of history at the California Institute of Technology. Dr. Rosenstone has served as historical consultant to such films as Reds and is the author of the recent Visions of the Past, The Challenge of Film to Our Idea of History. Welcome, Dr. Rosenstone.
Good to be here.
How have historians traditionally looked at historical films?
With annoyance, I think. Or maybe you should say historians haven't until fairly recently. Novick, in his survey of American history, a youth survey of American historical practice, found only a single mention of film, and he was covering 150 years of writing. And recently, I suppose, in the last 20 or 25 years, they've started to use film as sort of reflections of the periods in which they were made, even historical films. So there's very few people in the historical profession who take film seriously as a way of actually depicting the past, raising the kind of historical questions which we would raise in a written work of history.
And you speak in your book of dragnet historians approaching history. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's my own phrase, and it occurred to me when I started thinking about film and ways of writing history that that was the way I had been taught. Dragnet was, of course, an early TV show. It's still on the reruns 40 years later. in which Sergeant Joe Friday was always interviewing suspects for crimes and saying, just the facts, ma'am, we want just the facts. And that's when I went to graduate school 35 years ago, I was taught to get the facts, put them down and that on the page, and that was history. Nobody talked about the form in which you put them down, or when you started to put facts down, you had to make connections between them that weren't factual but were interpretive.
And you brought that attitude to film at first.
Yeah, when I first was involved in thinking about historical film, when I was involved in the production of a couple of films, I tended to criticize films, you know, because they got the facts wrong, or they made up things, or they invented things. And over time, I came to see that that was a too easy and too uninteresting way of looking at films, because much more is going on the screen in any film, and certainly in a historical film, than simply putting down a series of facts. It is, in fact, a kind of interpretation, or can be at its best, a kind of interpretation of a historical moment or person or event or period.
And why is the experience of seeing history on film so different from reading it in a book?
Well, boy, I guess we could all answer that for ourselves, but I think the major experience is that it collapses the distance that the historian normally takes, and therefore the reader normally takes, towards the past. That is, film is obviously, very obviously, in the present. There's no past tense in film. And obviously, film also focuses on individuals. It is a dramatic form, if we're talking about the feature film. And it focuses on individuals, their stories, which and the emotion-laden quality of their stories. So I think it's probably the emotion and the identification, which are much stronger with screen figures than with figures in, certainly in history books.
Now, when a film editor puts together a film, he uses thousands of images. And on the other hand, when a scholar puts together a book, he uses thousands of facts. And do you see a correlation between the composition of a film and a historical work?
Yeah, actually, I think that's a good analogy. They're very alike in many kinds of ways. You've said it. I don't have to repeat it, but I could point out the example I'd like to use with my students is a wonderful book by one of our great modern historians, Natalie Davis, called The Return of Martin Guerre. There was a film by the same name, which actually came up before the book, made in France. And Natalie Davis was consultant on the film, and then she was at the same time writing the book. And it's just a good example because the film matches the book in some ways, but you can see the historian, Natalie Davis, doing close-ups, giving little anecdotes, creating an overall dramatic structure, giving broad interpretive data, like a long shot in a film of a countryside, then coming in close to characters. And it's an interesting exercise to take a look at a history book and realize the wide variety of sources from which the data is being pulled together. I mean, this is a subject of a much longer conversation than we have, but I urge your listeners to try it sometime. It's an interesting experience.
Oh, yes. I mean, that The Return of Martin Guerre itself is an excellent film, and the book is very much worth reading.
Oh, yes.
Now, you mentioned before that many times when filmmakers make a film, they change the story a bit. They may compress characters, what have you. I mean, why can't they present a story straight, as it really was? What happens when producers, screenwriters, directors try to do a literal rendering of the past?
Yeah. Well, maybe we should back up before filmmakers and say that though the ideal of history from von Ranke in the 19th century was to tell the story as it really was, his phrase, nobody can tell the story as it really was because the past wasn't a story. The past was all this stuff which happened. Stories are things we create in the present to explain the past to ourselves. And so there's all this data, and historians too create stories. It's just we're so used to them, we're so acculturated to the particular stories of the United States, of George Washington, of our Civil War, of Vietnam, that we don't think about it. We think that was the past, but in fact it is a sort of highly selected and narrated view of the past. The thing that directors and screenwriters do is something different. I mean, both they do that, historians do that, but they also are working in a dramatic form, and they also have an audience, a large mass audience, and lots of money going into the film usually. So it's really the demands of drama, which has to heighten a certain kind of tension and release, that goes back to Aristotle. So there's no way of giving a straight literal history. What the best filmmakers do, filmmaker historians, is collapse multiple characters into a single character who may be an emblem for the working class, the rising bourgeoisie, the nobility, or collapse, so that's one kind of thing, a kind of putting it into drama by focusing sometimes on real characters, as you said earlier, sometimes on fictional characters. The most straight literal historical productions, I find, and there have been some attempted, but they're based on a kind of fiction too. The Adams Chronicles is one of them. It was a great TV special on PBS years ago, and its attempt to do realistic history as it was to have all the dialogue spoken by John Adams, Abigail Adams, John Quincy Adams, taken from their writing, which is a wonderful conceit, but ignores the fact that people don't speak like they write. And so it, too, could not be the past as it was. So I think this is the problem. There's all the stuff that's happened. We call them facts. We call it data. But the moment we start putting it into stories, we start creating certain kinds of fiction. The difference that films do is that they sort of invent larger fictions to stand for the past.
And as you say in your book, perhaps filmmakers are a little more open about admitting that it is a sort of fiction or a sort of selective process that's going on.
Yeah. Well, the word we use now is, you know, that we construct the past.
Yes.
Right, from the data. And so do filmmakers construct the past. I think the question is not whether the data is absolutely accurate, because it's not going to be. The camera demands more of the past than we would ever know how a room was furnished, exactly how somebody stood, spoke, walked. All these things are part of the meaning of the past, but we have to create that on the screen or on the page, or we leave it off the page and thereby have no sense of, say, people's posture. It may not be important in the book. But I think, to me, the important thing is the way that a film, a historical film, intersects which what I would call the discourse of history. And that is that any topic in the past, and again, the American Revolution, the Civil War, Vietnam, JFK, whatever you want to talk about, there's already a body of data, a body of debate, a body of interpretations over the particular topic. And what is important is whether the film, as it stands as a sort of half-fictional, half-historical work, makes a reasonable interpretation of that period of the past, even if there's inventions involved. In other words, it's not a literal truth on the screen, but it can raise historical questions which are of pressing importance to us and make interpretations of them, even with its included fictional elements. So that's the question I would ask. Is not are the facts right, but is the interpretation plausible? Does it intersect with the larger larger discourse of history? If you want, I can give a couple of examples about
that. Oh, yes, please.
Well, two films that people may very well have seen about a decade ago, both about dealing with African Americans. One was the film Glory, about the 54th Regiment in the Civil War, the first black regiment, to be followed by many others. Another was Mississippi Burning, which was about Mississippi Freedom Summer in the early 60s, and the murder of three civil rights workers. And I would contend both of them are based on real characters. Both of them contain large doses of invention by the part of the filmmaker. But I'd maintain that Glory is a reasonable and important work of history because of the way it intersects with, and of course brings us the feeling of, what it was like to be a African-American soldier entering the Northern Army in the Civil War. And Mississippi Burning, and let me just say with Glory for a second, its interpretation, though it's fiction, kind of stands for the entire black experience of the Civil War in the military. And it, while the characters are invented, and even some of the incidents, the overall experience is certainly quite true to what we know about those experiences. Mississippi Burning, by contrast, shifts, so I'd say glory sort of intersects with the discourse of history. Mississippi Burning kind of trashes the discourse of history because it takes this whole, it puts the FBI at the center of a story which is really about civil rights and black America at a time when we know the FBI wasn't very interested and eventually had to be goaded by the president into investigating the murders. There's more to be said, but there's a way in which it ignores what we know about that period, marginalizes African Americans at their own voting rights drive, and puts the FBI at the center of the story. So to me, this is much less interesting, much less valuable as history, though it does raise something about terrorism of the Klan towards blacks in the 1960s. It's not a totally worthless film, but I think it doesn't really engage the historical questions of civil rights and attempting to register black voters.
Sometimes people refer to the age in which we're living as moving into a post-literate society. What is that, and why is visual media so important to it?
Well, again, I think we all sort of know that without even thinking about it. I mean, the visual media have clearly are in the process of, and in many areas have, replaced the book as the way we talk to ourselves about ourselves. I mean, after people leave high school or college, they rarely read a history book again, and those of us who write history books know because of our sales, right? Whereas they're going to be subjected or subject themselves or take themselves to this visual media which delivers the world to us in a often sugar-coated form, sometimes in a serious form. So, I mean, this is why I got interested in history on film. I have written several traditional works of history, but one of the reasons is that people don't read them. And to talk about historical film, of course, is to talk about teaching people how to read these films in a way, in the sense that you read the book. You can't just be a couch potato with a historical film. What I like about such films is they tend to raise for people the same kinds of issues that history books do, and even sometimes engage us in these large public debates. I mean, JFK would have been, a lot of Oliver Stone's films raised a big fuss and caused the public at large, even people who hadn't seen the film and certainly had never read a book on JFK or, say, Nixon, to start thinking about those historical questions. And to me, history isn't just depicting the past. It's, of course, how we think about the past, how the past means to us today.
Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have today.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rosenstone.
My pleasure.
We've been talking today with Dr. Robert A. Rosenstone, Professor of History at the California Institute of Technology, author of Visions of the Past, The Challenge of Film to Our Idea of History.
Atomic bomb cinema, films in which the bomb plays a major role, has long been a major part of the American film industry. Even before the atomic bomb became a reality in 1945, Hollywood produced a steady stream of bomb films, many of which were concerned as well with the apocalypse, another subject near and dear to our hearts as we approach the end of the second millennium. Here to talk about the atomic bomb cinema and the apocalypse is Jerome Shapiro, professor and resident cinema studies scholar at Hiroshima University in Japan. Professor Shapiro has written extensively on American and Japanese cinema and culture. He's also the author of the forthcoming book, Nuclear Shadows on Silvered Walls, Atomic Bomb Cinema from 1935 to the Millennium.
In the Western world, every period of crisis is accompanied by maverick intellectuals who leave the monastery to exhort the people to righteousness. In our own time, this exhortation has welded two very different technologies into a single, omni-terrifying demon. Indeed, Many prominent intellectuals tell us that because we worship at the altar of nuclearism, we are psychically numb. And the source of all this evil is Hollywood. Each year, Americans see approximately 12 films about the bomb. That's a lot. There are now more than 700 such films. I call this body of films atomic bomb cinema. The single most common element in atomic bomb cinema is the apocalyptic imagination. At its root, the term apocalypse means something revealed, as in a dream or vision, and suggests rebirth, not death. Some bomb films evoke a Christian-style messianic apocalypse. Most bomb films, however, are structured like ancient Jewish apocalyptic texts. There is usually an otherworldly journey in time or space. The future is revealed and interpreted, and the journeyer returns to exhort the people to righteousness. For example, the narrative and imagery of the 1960 film, The Time Machine, the 1984 film, The Terminator, and the 1995 film, Waterworld, are all structured by the apocalyptic tradition. This structure does help formulate a social critique, but the apocalyptic tradition is really a poetics for expressing our feelings or experiences of the world. More importantly, this poetry exhorts us to survive and self-actualize under oppressive conditions. Hollywood is indeed a grave source of concern, but a far bigger problem is that politicians and pundits have collectively forgotten their freshman literature classes. They cast aside informed criticism and use Hollywood as a whipping boy to advance their own agendas. Even the reactionary film commentator, Michael Medved, completely forgoes the Jewish traditions he claims to embrace, such as Midrash, a cornerstone to Western interpretive theories. And in the classroom, many of my colleagues exhort an anti-nuclear or anti-Hollywood ideology instead of fostering a wide range of critical skills necessary to formulating an independent conclusion. Be that as it may, after watching nearly 700 bomb films, I have come to a very politically incorrect conclusion. Atomic bomb cinema is a vital part of contemporary society because it contributes to the process by which we come to understand and give meaning to the events of our times. And, more importantly, because it exhorts us to survive and develop a more spiritually fulfilling life under the oppressive shadow of the bomb.
You've been listening to Jerome Shapiro, professor and resident cinema studies scholar at Hiroshima University. This is Talking History. As you might expect, for our site of the week, we recommend a visit to a site where you'll learn much about the history of the cinema. But, as we do upon occasion, we've chosen a site to which you can travel without leaving your armchair. It's a website, and here to describe it for you is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The American Film Institute website offers you a selection of topics from the 100 movies of all time to the top 100 stars. There are sections on filmmakers, actors, and film news, and there is even a trivia game to test your knowledge of more than 400 movies in Name That Movie. Find everything you want to know about any of the top 100 movies of all time and more with just a click of your mouse. The website is located at www.afionline.org or just search for the American Film Institute homepage with your favorite search engine.
And finally, as part of our weekly coming attractions, we alert you to two historical museum exhibits in photography and art. Fame After Photography, an exhibit on photography's influence on the cultural experience of fame, has opened at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. It's an unconventional and timely exhibit that tracks how the public's fascination with fame was transformed by and has evolved since the invention of photography in 1839. It features a wide variety of 19th and 20th century images, including not only photographs, but advertisements, postcards, newspapers, magazines, newsreels, movie stills, television clips, and images from digital and electronic media. Call the Museum of Modern Art in New York City for further information on this exhibit, which closes on October 5th. If you're interested in Western art, you might sign up for the symposium on that subject, scheduled for September 10th at the Charles M. Russell Center for the Study of the American West in Norman, Oklahoma. The Russell Center was established in 1998 at the University of Oklahoma School of Art with the goal of studying and cultivating a better understanding and appreciation of Western and Native American art. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week for our special Labor Day show. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian Lebeau. Thank you.